Hello, and welcome to the Agile Embedded Podcast. I'm Jeff Gable.
And I'm Luke Anjani.
And today we are doing a special crossover episode with Ryan Torvik, Luca's co-host on the Embedded AI Podcast. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Woo! Welcome to the show. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me. Us.
Fantastic.
All right, who's running the show? Where are we going? How are we going to start this out?
Well, I guess since I'm the common element, I should perhaps say a few words. Because, dear listeners, you might know me from the Agile Embedded Podcast, which I've been running with Jeff for, oh God, how long has it been? 3 years now, Jeff?
Four years. I guess.
And Ryan and me just started a new podcast, which is the Embedded AI Podcast, because, you know, AI is, I've heard it's all the rage these days.
It is. It is. It's in everything. It's from your coffee machine to your refrigerator to your car to the airplanes that we're riding in. Like, it's in a lot of things.
Yeah. And so we figured, you know what? We should just get together and have a crossover episode that's going to be published on both podcasts. Because why not?
Well, in our conversations about using AI, especially in a development standpoint, we've talked about, like, hey, we actually do agile things because of the, like, how useful it is for spitting out useful code and usable code using the AI. It's like, oh, we're doing agile and AI. Oh, we should talk about it.
Exactly.
I like it.
So, and we are part of the Luca's cinematic universe of podcasts. Like, just bring it all together.
What are we talking all about today anyway?
Jeff, what are we talking about today?
So I'll say that, you know, I'm still a bit of a noob in terms of a user of LLMs for coding and for development. And so, I don't know, in my few forays into it, I feel like I keep messing it up. And so I'm wondering if you guys can maybe review with me some common patterns of how beginners mess up when they first start using AI to help with development, and then maybe we can talk about some solutions for those.
Yeah. Well, and I'd like to clarify too. You mentioned that you feel new to the system. All of us are new to this experience. Like, no matter how much you see somebody or you talk to somebody, they're like, oh yeah, they've been doing it for months. If they've been doing it for weeks, maybe they've been doing it for months, but no one's been doing this for, it's not somebody that went to school back in the 80s and like, oh, I've been doing this for 40 years. Like, nobody has that level of experience. So we're all just running around bumping into things and seeing what works for us and trying on new things. So I think it is okay to feel like a noob, and that's fine. That's great. We should totally do that. But at the same time, yes, Luke and I have run into a few things that, yeah, we've messed some things up. Let's figure out what we're doing. So let's talk about the tool set, just the beginning tool set, like how you even interact with an LLM. The basic ways we've listed out like three different ways of actually interacting. We've got web interfaces, we've got CLIs, and we've got IDE plugins. The web interface is like you bring up your browser, Chrome, Firefox, Safari. Is Opera still a thing? Edge, Brave, Lynx. If you got Lynx still, you go up and you go to openai.com, you create a thing, and then you start typing into the box there, and then it dumps out stuff on your screen, and you go back and forth with it.
Yeah, and actually, that's not a bad way to get started, I guess, because it's such a low barrier to entry. But the downside is there is so much friction, right? I mean, how do you get the code out of your browser? You're essentially condemned to copy and paste back and forth between the browser and your IDE or your terminal or whatever, which gets old very quickly. So I think it's an excellent way to get started. And I still do it sometimes, like if I'm just sort of figuring out a small niche topic, like, writing a script for whatever purpose, then maybe it's just easier to say essentially on a whim, write me a script that deletes all files that were created on Wednesdays and just like copy that, stick it in your shell and run it. But yeah, the longer your interaction becomes, the less convenient that is. And then I think you need to decide whether you are more of a command line guy like me, Claude Code or Ada or what's it called? ChatGPT Codex, I think it's called. And, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Or whether you are more of an IDE person and you prefer to use...
Is that me? Is that, am I the one am I the one fighting for the IDE in this conversation? Like, I was a command line guy for years and years and years, and then all these people using Eclipse, I'm like, what's wrong with you? Like, why are you doing this to yourself? And then like VS Code came out and it has VI integrations. I'm like, all right, I can't go back. This is weird.
The interesting thing is, like, this is actually fairly somehow profound, I find. You know, the best user interface, the best human machine interface for an LLM is not settled yet. And I feel like present IDEs just aren't it for me, because I feel like I use an IDE to interact with the code, but I don't use it to interact with an LLM. It doesn't feel right for me personally. And this is exactly why I want to have a separate form of interaction, in this case, you know, command lines. And if I do need to work with the code, then I will go back to the IDE. So it's not one or the other. Like, I will prompt the LLM to write some code for me, and then I'll jump into VS Code and look at it in VS Code and perhaps change it. And then I go back to the LLM and say, well, I made some changes. You know, take it and run with it.
Yeah. I think there's one that I haven't tried, and I'm just I don't know how to feel about it when I do get around to trying it, which is like just shouting at your computer, you know, putting a microphone on it and just shouting at the LLM and seeing like what happens, and then having it read back to you what it's going to do.
Voice coding modes, but I feel like they are not going to be very convenient. Like, I need to sort of sit there and stare at my prompt for a while and then decide, yeah, this is actually good. And then I fire it off. I don't think it works for programming.
Yeah. Well, and the amount of data, so if you're working with DeepSnell, the amount of data it gives you back, that I'm like, I don't care about this. I don't care about this. I just skim. Okay, this is the part that I actually care about. So I'll just do that. So imagine like someone trying to read you their book report that they just wrote. And I'm like, oh, come on, this is taking too long.
So I have a question. So along the prompt line, so I'm, again, as a noob, I've played around with it and I've, you know, mildly followed the conversation. And so I understand that you need to be specific with your prompts, that it's better to have a conversation with the LLM rather than just, and, you know, essentially you and the LLM iterate towards your solution. Maybe give me a few tips or ways to mess that up. Essentially, I guess maybe the way I would mess it up is trying to ask for everything in one shot. I think that's probably what I tried first. And I got everything back. And again, it's basically gives you way too much. And that's one of the early anti-patterns, is that the AI will write a whole bunch of code that looks great and actually throws something up on the screen, but then you realize it's just way too much to understand and has made architecture decisions that you don't agree with. And so what are some, you know, other ways to mess that up and some ways to fix it?
I think a good way of thinking about using the AI, and I would like to apologize publicly right now for everyone who's ever had to work with me, but like, you know, someone who is just absolutely 100% pedantic and not maliciously going after and be like, well, this is what you asked for. But like when you go to an AI, you have to really think about, well, and they have stories about this. You know, we tell fairy tales and stuff like, you know, you interact with the devil and the devil gets you because of the wording that you used when you made your request. Like, well, technically this makes it feels like dealing with an LLM. You have to be careful about what you're asking for, so that, because it will technically make what you asked for. And if you didn't ask for that, it's like, well, you should have asked for that. So I think that's for sure. When you're asking for too much, or you're being vague with the terminology that you're using, or you're just saying, yeah, something like this. It's really tough. And then, but at the same time, if you're new to this and you go and you start looking online, you see people with these like pages of prompt, like, here's my prompt, here's my thing. It's like, oh my gosh, in order to get an LLM to do what I want to do, I have to have a page of prompt in order to like get something useful. I may as well just do it myself at that point. Like, holy cow. But yeah, if you're not specific enough, then it just, it'll totally just run all over the place.
Yeah, exactly. So, and this is, I think, how you get to those really flashy demos where somebody says, you know, I can write you an Asteroids clone, you know, Asteroids, the game from the 80s, in 10 minutes from a single prompt. That kind of thing works as long as your intentions are suitably vague. Like, it just has to be a game with like sprites flying around and hitting other sprites. And as long as your idea is that vague, it works impressively well. But if you're more specific, like if you have very specific ideas of how it should work or how it must work, then you really have to be very pedantic about it and say, no, it has to be exactly this way and very much not that way, and think about this other thing. And this is how you end up with those pages and pages of prompts. Like my base prompt is probably 2-3 screens full of things that I sort of distilled. It's a matter of repeating yourself often enough, like, no, you did this wrong. No, you did this wrong again. And it's, okay, fine, I'll stick it into my base prompt, because you're going to do it every time. And I'm just going to tell you up front, no, this is not what I want. So
I think that
you really need to be very, very clear, and that sort of force yourself to actually think it through yourself, and then you can give good prompts.
Do you recommend, so in terms of that, you know, page or more long default prompt that essentially is included with every single request, it's correct me if I'm wrong, you essentially say, like, these are the ground rules for this session. Do you recommend, so for me as someone who doesn't have that, do you recommend that I go on the web and search for, hey, good rules for Claude code, or should I experiment on my own and start small and be agile and build it up from there? Or has enough work gone into these where it's worth going out and finding someone's and using that as the starting point? What would you recommend to me as a beginner?
I mean, you can, but I like I really like just going out there and trying. And getting frustrated with the AI and getting frustrated with the LLM and kind of learning.
By going out and trying, you mean essentially like building starting with nothing and me discovering through the course of working with it.
Yeah.
What I need to tell it and then adding that to that initial reprompt, I guess.
Yep. And that's to me, that's what I've really liked, because then you really understand what you're asking for.
Right.
You're going to pull something online like, yeah, it's okay. But then you're spending a lot of time like, well, do I need that?
Maybe looking at ones online for inspiration, but not copy pasting.
Yes, very much. Because they are not going to fit your style. But so I would actually suggest, I mean, like Ryan says, whatever, it's fine. Look around, gather some inspiration. But I think it's much more helpful to sort of think about what you care about and not even think about it actively, but sort of as you're coding and as you're interacting with the LLM, you notice, okay, it's doing this thing that I'm not happy with, or I need to remind it to do this thing that I care about. Then you just take it, you just write it down. And actually, you can have the LLM help you with that. Like, you know, you can tell it, write me a good prompt to code in a test-driven development style. And it will, you know, it will create your prompt. And it's going to be its prompt, not yours. So you should go through it and say, well, no, this is, you know, this is too much. This is overdoing it or something, and modify. But it is a very helpful starting point. And you will go, I should have thought of that.
Yeah, it depends on your tool set too. So RuCode, which I used for a while, had a little button. Instead of sending the prompt that I just typed, it would actually, you could enhance it. And so it would like, okay, let's, and so it would try to make a better prompt for your prompt that you just sent out. And like, it was an informative session. I don't use it anymore, because I was actually copying I'd have to copy my prompt because I couldn't get it back. It was like, oh, here you go. And I'm like, no, you missed the point. But then it's like, oh yes, you're pedantic. You're just following the instructions. I get it. Of course you missed the point, because I didn't specify the point. But yeah.
Okay. All right. I like that. All right. So my next question has to do with context management. So again, as a beginner, I know the phrase, I understand the concept. I will say, like, yeah, I don't get how you specify certain things. And maybe it's just dependent on the tool. But, you know, if I have a large code base, it probably can't fit everything in that code base in the context. So
what
do I need to manually specify files?
Wrong?
Okay. So how... What are some of the best, what are the anti-patterns there and some of the best ways to go?
Yes, files, like it'll happily eat all your files. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, we talked about this actually in one of our upcoming previous shows. I don't remember where we are in the order of time.
Yeah, it's the upcoming episode.
Yes, the upcoming episode. So yep. we, So we talk about like, okay, how you like what the AI actually cares about. It's kind of like the beginning and the end, and all the stuff in the middle just kind of gets lost. And so like there's ways of managing that. But yeah, if you get more hallucinogenic, is that right? Hallucinatory results as your context window gets bigger, because it's just, there's just too much to keep track of. And you think it's a computer. Yes, it's a computer. Like, it has working memory. It's so confusing. Like, exactly, to think about, try to map these behaviors onto how human beings behave. But yeah, there is definitely an amount of working memory, and the LLM get confused, and the hallucinations are real, man. They are super real.
Well, yeah, and you know, an LLM is just, you know, is human as well. So just like a human remembers most strongly the things at the beginning and at the end, so does an LLM. So the things that you stick fairly early into its context, so into its working memory, if you will, have a fairly strong weight. And the things that are at the very end also have a fairly strong weight. Whereas the stuff in the middle, like Ryan said, sort of, it's not like they are not there, but they are somehow less powerful an influence on whatever the LLM returns.
And it's unpredictable.
And also, an LLM will tend to forget stuff at the beginning over time. So like, if you prompted something at the beginning of a session, say, for instance, I always say, always use TDD, always write tests first. And it will do that for the first couple of turns, and then it will forget, start writing implementation without tests. And I'd say, wait, what did we say we wanted to do? Oh, yes, you're sorry.
Yes, I'm so sorry, you're right.
So
is the context solely like the prompts you're putting in? Like,
okay,
is there a file that do you write a file that then describes what files to read?
Or no.
Do you
okay.
say, please ingest these
we
files?
Should, yeah, we should explain how that actually works. So
please do.
Context, of course, is sort of all of this, all of the input data that you give the LLM. So it will be your prompt, its system prompt that you cannot see, the application prompt that might exist, and all of the files that you made available to it by whatever method. You know, maybe you copy and pasted it into a text box, or maybe the application, such as, you know, your VS Code plugin, was able to read the file and inject the file contents into essentially the standard input, if you like, of the LLM. And also the entirety of your conversation. So you prompted something, it returns something. You prompted something else, it returns something else. That entire thing gets repasted and repasted into the LLM's context window. This is how it works.
Right.
So it gets that longer and longer and longer.
That makes sense. So you're a fan of Ader. So I'm just going to talk about Ader for a second. Mm-hmm. So does it have a special, I don't know, slash command or whatever to say, like, read these particular files in our current working directory and add those to your context?
Yeah, exactly. So all,
but not
all applications that I'm aware of allow you to tell them what to read. Like in Cloud Code,
it's
at, you know, at such and such file name, and says, read this file and add it to your context.
Okay.
In Ada, it's slash, what was it? Slash add, I think.
Okay, got it. All right.
And so they all but they can also on their own decide, you know, I really need to read this file because I have somehow determined that its contents are relevant.
Oh, yeah. Cloud Code really likes to grep. It's like, oh, I'm looking for this pattern.
Yeah,
and so it'll grep your entire baseline and then find the file names where that have that pattern in it. And then it'll go through sequentially one by one. Like, okay, I'm going to read this file, because that's where I found it. If it grabs line numbers, it might actually, if it's smart enough, it depends. You never know what it's going to do. But it might just grab the lines around that. It's like, okay, I know that this is the function name, so I'm going to start here and read like 50 lines and see where it's going to be.
Yeah, but I think we need to pull this back. So anyway, long story short, there's many different sources of input to an LLM. And the thing is, you need to be very judicious about what you input into the LLM. If you give it too little, unsurprisingly, it will not give you good results, right? It will have to either make assumptions and probably get them wrong, or just plain not know about something. Like if it doesn't know about a certain function, it can't possibly use it, can it?
But it's happy to create one for you.
Yeah, that can happen. But the point is, you can also give it too much. Like if you overwhelm it with all of the files, it will get confused, and because it's an LLM, and it will not give up. It will keep generating. It will generate something. It will just not generate something very helpful.
Got it.
You know, we should talk about hallucinations, because there is this term hallucination, which is considered to mean, you know, something an LLM made up, which is not actually truthful or grounded in reality or something. But the point is, that is a human term. As far as an LLM is concerned, there is no such thing as a hallucination. Or maybe it's more fair to say they always hallucinate. It is just it is just a token generator. You stick an input in, and it returns an output, and it has no way of judging whether this is, you know, correct or valid or useful or something. It's just whatever it generated. So it's up to you to give it input data that will very likely result in useful output data.
Right. Along those lines, so testing. this is maybe part of a so you know, listeners of the Agile Embedded podcast will know that both Luca and I are big fans of test-driven development and writing tests as we are coding, and indeed writing a test before you write code, watching it fail, writing code, watching it pass, refactoring, the red-green refactor loop. And you know, writing AI code is just a really easy way to get away from that. And so you know, the term that's in our little summary here and that I've personally experienced is vibe coding yourself off a cliff, where essentially I wrote a bunch of code, or had AI write a bunch of code, and 20 minutes later, literally deleted everything and just started from scratch.
I am a huge fan of that, by the way. I am absolutely a huge fan of that. I think everyone should feel comfortable doing that.
And for prototyping and stuff, that's fine. But when I actually do want to make progress and do want to work my way towards production code, you know, how do we do it in small chunks and with tests, but still take advantage of the speed of AI? So we're not.
I think that's a common misconception too, is that like, well, I don't need to write tests anymore. The AI is writing all the code, so it's good. I think that the tests serve the same function that you saw before. You mentioned earlier about like, oh, I created an asteroids app in an afternoon. It's great. You know, this is what I've talked to so much over the years about, like, university. One of the things you have with the university is that you spend 15 weeks on a project and then you never look at it again. Like, that's not reality. It's really easy to write a project in 15 weeks. Like, it is really hard to maintain a project over 5 years and, like, deal with the way that everything changes over time. And so similarly with the AI, like, yes, you can get something up and running, but how are you actually going to maintain this and, like, adapt this to changing requirements and changing needs for the rest of your working life, or until someone rips it out of your cold, dead hands? Like, how do you actually do that? And I think that's where the Agile really, really plays a role in this, and being able to understand the Agile methods so that you can then apply them to interacting with the AI. And, you know, not using tests is a great way to find yourself off in la-la land, and like, AI has written all this code. You don't really know what any of it does. And you don't really have an idea of how to interact with it, because what do tests do? The tests tell you how this is supposed to work. And so you can go ahead and actually have it write the test first and then evaluate the test. You can write the test yourself and say, like, this is the spec that I want you to fill in. So there's a lot of different ways that you can kind of control the output and kind of like frame it so that you get that better, like, no, this is exactly what I mean. This is more specific, more clear. And using tests helps it helps you understand what you're trying to do personally, but then it's also an effective way of communicating, just like you would to another person. No, it needs to function like this. It needs to actually it needs to have this functionality and behave in this way. When you get this input, you should get this output. And so test-driven development, like, is perfect for using AIs, because you're telling the AI, write whatever you want, hallucinate whatever code you want, as long as it meets these criteria.
That's exactly my stance as well. Like, I find myself being even more aggressively biased towards test-driven development. And while I'm reasonably lenient about the code that the LLM writes, I am very pedantic about the tests that I'm using. And yes, I will have the LLM write tests for me, but I will very thoroughly review them and like really tweak them until they have the level of detail that I'm interested in. And then I can, like, you know, like Ryan said, have the LLM go wild and write whatever code. I don't care. As long as the tests pass and as long as I feel confident about my tests and that they really do protect me from coding myself off a cliff. So that's really crucial. And in fact, that is one of the things that I've learned also the hard way is that you really need to slow an LLM down there, and because it will be happy. It will be absolutely happy to generate tests for you. It will generate like 100 tests for you in one go.
Oh my gosh. The LLM is like the happiest developer that I've The happiest developer that I've ever worked with is the AI, is an LLM. It is just so excited and happy to do more work than you could ever possibly imagine. Like, yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I have very, 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 very strict prompts to say, don't ever generate more than 3 test cases in one go and then stop and let me review them and then incorporate my comments into those tests. And then, and then we keep iterating.
And so I've, you know, again, in monitoring conversations around this on Hacker News or wherever else, you know, people talk about having agents that will do certain things for you. And maybe they're specialized for that. So there's agents that will, you know, compile the code for you and fix it. And it kind of seems like this, this too good to be true world of you're managing these things that are doing all the different tasks for you. For someone who is a beginner, who is getting started, maybe what I would probably try first, given my blowups in the past when I've, you know, tried to get it to write too much and I just had to throw it out and start over, I would do thing like I would decide on an architecture myself. And maybe I could do that with a back and forth of like, hey, I'm wanting to write an application like this, suggest, you know, the major subsystems and how they fill up. But essentially I would get to an architecture description of how I'm breaking up this program. And then one at a time, okay, let's write the interface file for that thing. Okay, let's write some unit tests for that and essentially do each of those pieces. And each one of those is going to allow, like, involve me not being satisfied with the output and making changes and then committing that. And then say, okay, based on that, write the code. Mm-hmm. And maybe write it just one function at a time. And again, I review that. So does that seem to me to you like a reasonable way to get started? And would kind of, again, take advantage of LLMs and get faster output, but keep it at the high quality that I need to.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't ever let go of the reins.
Okay.
Well, and I think in the AI space, the word for that, they like you put together a product requirements document. And this is where, and you know, Lucas talked about this a lot, about being a requirements engineer at the end of the day now, because you are telling the LLM this, and I don't really want to care about where the semicolons go or the names of the variables or, you know, the function signatures anymore. I don't really care about any of that level of detail, but I do care about that the thing actually functions the way I want it to function and gives me the output that I want when I'm interacting with it. So being very clear with that and like going through that methodically and like setting it up, you know, it's something that it's something that we should have been doing the entire time. Is that responsible people have been saying, this is how you do engineering. And like, no, it's software. You don't understand. You just start throwing your fingers to the keys. And then like the code comes out and it's done. It's great. And then all these people are like, they're talking about doors and they're talking about requirements analysis and mapping from system level to software level. And they're like, no, I throw my fingers on the keys and the code comes out. Like, so it's actually forcing us to have better. If you want to get consistent, reliable results, you have to go and do that system level understanding of the problem space before you actually ask the LLM to do something. And I want to point out something here too, for folks that are, you know, hesitant to try to let it code for you because you're really good at coding, you are, but the LLM will think of solutions that you never thought of. I would never have thought to put a for loop in that to handle this. I would have never thought to put the switch case and do that. You know, there are lots of solutions that I don't bother to do because of the amount of typing and copy paste and boilerplate that I'd have to do and all this other engineering. Like the LLM will just happily just, you know, you think like, okay, if I want to type up this whole thing and it's like, okay, I got to put aside some time, make sure, okay, but I, you know, don't make the coffee yet or don't put the coffee on, then spend 30 minutes, like type. The LLM will dump out that entire concept of that file in seconds. And so you don't really have to consider how long it's going to take to type something or how many things you're going to have to think of. Oh, I've got a dictionary open at all times so I can think of good names for my variables. Like you don't need to care about that anymore, ever. Like, that's not a thing, because the LLM will just dump it out there and then we'll be able to figure it out. So like, being able to step away from the nitty gritty of it is so refreshing. But you got to keep the reins on. You can't just let it go run rampant around an entire code space.
Yeah, and it'll sneak up on you. Like, it's not like you make a conscious decision to let go of the reins. They will just sort of slowly slip out of your hands, and all of a sudden you find yourself sitting there like a fool with nothing in your hands.
So
it knocked out all of your tests to be meaningless.
So I would say maybe something that I would do to especially keep a handle on that is, you know, essentially be making commits in Git, like all the time, so that at any point I can easily revert and say nope. Because I've had that thing where, you know, you tell the LLM to do something, it does too much, and you say revert that. Well, that's just it doing more work to try to undo its previous work. It can't actually undo it. And so you need to, it would seem to me that I need to be committing little pieces that I like, and even work in progress that I don't like, but that I can see, you know, the germ of possibility. And then I can always just wipe out everything in the working directory and restore it to the, you know, the head of whatever branch I'm on, and go from there.
I'm glad that the people are still calling it extreme programming. Like, this is, you should, what's, you know, figure out what the big problem you're trying to solve. What's the first step that I can take towards solving that problem? And then have the LLM solve that first step and then commit it, push it, get your tests run and everything. And then, okay, now I've got a clean slate. What's the next step that I can take? Like, effectively using an LLM I have found that to be an extremely effective way of interacting with an LLM and getting the results you want by using that extreme programming or DevOps or whatever you want to call it, agile, like that. Like, what's the step, what's the chunk that I can do right now to get towards the end goal without losing track of what the end goal is, but like, what's that step I can take?
Would you actually, so that seems like an opportunity essentially to rebuild your context from scratch.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So as soon as you have made a commit that you are satisfied with, you're like, okay, this is actually production quality. I would tend to essentially get rid of, like, start a new session and reintroduce the base prompt and reread the files that are now germane to the next step, and essentially not allow the context of previous good quality chunks to build up. Seem reasonable?
Absolutely. And I mean, you can even sort of have your cake and eat it too, by telling the LLM to dump the present context out into a text file, and then wiping your context, and then ingesting this text file back in, presumably after you've made edits and said, "Well, this is stupid. I don't need this anymore." Like,
it got this thing wrong. Yeah,
exactly. And then you pull that in and say, "Okay, this is our starting point. Let's go." That is very helpful. And in a sense, to expand on what Ryan said earlier, this is kind of how I also attack challenges now. Like, you know, I come up with this high level idea, then I flesh it out in conversation with an LLM, dump those ideas to a file, and it's like, okay, I need to write this module, and say, okay, fine, let's pick the first module, now let's break that down, let's, you know, flesh that out even more. And then once I'm happy with that, you know, iteratively, then I say, okay, that first chunk of work that we identified, pull that out, use that as your initial prompt. Now let's start coding. Let's start writing the first handful of tests and then write the implementation. And so it goes. Like, you know, I'm essentially using the V model very, very deliberately. Yeah. And, you know, all of the agilists are probably having a fit right now. But this is the point, right? You have this very global idea of where you want to go. You break it down. You break it down even more.
And then tiny little V's.
Exactly. Then you at a level that is actually actionable and like fits into your brain and fits into the LLM's brain, then you deal with that, and then you sort of percolate back up, take the next element.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I found, so even before I started all this vibe coding stuff, like, I found the last several years that the I would flush my own context. Like once I committed something and it was now on the main branch, I didn't have to think about it anymore. But until I had actually closed that work that I was doing, committed it, made the pull request, got it through tests, and then I was like, okay, now I can actually process the next step that I'm trying to take. And you know, good engineering practice about this. And the nice thing about software is that you can change the direction you're going in too. So like once you've kind of made these steps, you understand the problem space a lot more, and then you can go back and update that design and kind of figure it out. Like it's really forcing me to be a better engineer by using the LLM.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, can I just say something very quickly? Something that is also very valuable about LLMs I found is that they make it sometimes much easier to refactor or to sort of reassess where you are. Just today, I noticed that I was getting confused about the attributes of, you know, some data attributes that I was working with. And I said, you know, summarize them for me. Look around the code, find what's there, summarize it for me. It made the summary. And I noticed, you know, some parts of it just don't make sense. And then we sort of discussed this and said, you know, this is stupid. This needs to go. There's a contradiction here. And then once we had reached an understanding of what was wrong, I said, okay, now please go through the code and make the appropriate changes, you know, throw out this attribute, make sure that there's a validation over here, et cetera, et cetera. Extremely helpful. It would have taken me like half a day of poring over code. I was like, what's this doing here? This is very strange. I did that in like 15 minutes, and it was so, so useful and so much more enjoyable than having to slog through it.
Right. All right. What about, since this is the Agile Embedded podcast,
yeah,
so you know, for our listeners who have drunk our Kool-Aid and are, you know, really trying to do things in an agile way with tight feedback loops, the like at the individual coder level, everything we've talked about makes sense. Like not having the LLM go off the rails and essentially keeping a tight iteration loop and a tight feedback loop for you personally as a coder, but for a larger team. How do you see, like, and you now have a team of 5, 10, 20 larger teams, developers, incorporating AI into and LLMs into their, you know, minute-to-minute workflow? How does that affect a larger team and, say, a manager or an executive who's in charge of that team? What effects do you think they're going to see and how they should deal with it?
I think before we answer that, I do want to just... I just want to like try to clear up some, there's been, and we'll see, we'll actually see what happens. Anybody who says they know what's going to happen with AI in the next month, 2 months, 6 months, year, 3 years, 5 years, whatever, don't believe them. Like it's just, it's not happening. So you may have heard people saying like, oh, well, that entire process that you just said, there's only going to be one person in that. And it's going to be the executive making the decisions. And then they're just going to farm all that out to all these different like tens of AIs that are then farming out to tens of AIs that like, so that is not in the near, not anywhere near in the future. Like, cause we've interacted with these things and we've seen like, this is really easy to go sideways. So it's like, we're definitely nowhere near that, if that ever happens at all. But yeah, so I think in the bigger sense, there are things like static analysis tools and code review tools that are, there's a lot of concern that they're going to be obsolete because of how that you can use the AI to just say, okay, no, actually go and evaluate this from Mistral standards and then go make the changes and put them back in. Go evaluate this code from that kind of standpoint. So I think that at a more organizational level, you can have the AI doing some of those, what would be the next team down from you, tasks to go and verify and validate your code or your system.
But I will say, you know, I work in medical devices and you know, for medical devices and any other safety critical industry, automotive, aerospace, industrial automation, you know, nuclear power generation, everything, predictability and reliability is king. And there is no way in hell that I will ask an AI to review my code. I might do that as one of a check. It would never replace an actual deterministic static analysis.
Are you going to say a deterministic human?
Deterministic is actually the word I was trying to think
Are you going to say a deterministic human? Because hold on.
No. A deterministic static analysis tool that would review it the same way every time. Like to me, like absolutely in addition to have an LLM suggest, like review it and make suggestions.
I think that
I cannot see a universe where something based on an LLM, which is inherently non-deterministic, would replace deterministic quality tools in a safety critical context.
I think that your statement is absolutely correct, but I think that the value that those static analysis tools in helping you find the bugs and then fix them will be significantly reduced if you use an LLM ahead of time to go ahead and take those things out, that the deterministic static analysis tool would be merely a formality. Like the thing that we've always wanted them to be is merely a formality that we just run this once right as the box is getting ready to move out of the door. That we just run this once, it's like, yeah, we're good. Like that's what you should expect from those kinds of deterministic tools later.
Or actually, you just put it in your CI and it runs on every commit.
Yeah, I mean, firstly, yes, that. Secondly, I think static analysis tools absolutely still have their place in two ways. One way is that they are deterministic, like you say, and that can be a value in itself. But also, they are much cheaper. They are much faster than an LLM. So it makes a lot of sense to have them as sort of the first line and knock out all of the easy stuff. And only the stuff that they miss will then be given to an LLM and it'll look it over once more. And only then, this is, I think, where we are going to go, will a human look it over. So I think human code reviews still make a lot of sense, but they will be different. Like just like a code review after running static analysis tool will be different because certain classes of defects will just be gone already.
Why would it be different though? How, like, I would push back on that again. Mm-hmm. Someone who is not experienced in this, but mm-hmm. and maybe part of this is based on there was a Hacker News discussion the other day of someone asked the question, like, you know, I'm maintaining an open source project. I'm getting all these 1,000 line pull requests that were clearly AI generated. And how am I supposed to review them? And everyone responded, review them the way you would as if they were a human. If they're too big to review, reject them.
Yes, absolutely.
You don't change your process just because people are now using AIs to generate their code.
No, I absolutely agree. This is what this person should do. Like, that was just a bad pull request.
No, of course. But I'm saying in general, I feel like, you know, I don't know that, I don't see how code reviews are going to change. Because every person is going to be responsible for their code, whether they physically typed it in or had an LLM type it in.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is an entirely different conversation altogether. Like, is there ever a transfer of responsibility? I'd say no. Like, if you're using Microsoft Word to type your essay, is Microsoft now on the hook for your essay being bad? No.
Right.
So, you know, it's still your work.
I'd like to see that. I just see what that, how that works out. It's like, well, I wrote this safety critical system using Claude, and now I'm going to sue Anthropic because the car crashed. Like,
yeah,
it's going to happen.
But anyway, so essentially you will still want to review your code, if only to like make sure that the LLM didn't miss anything. And it will. Like, LLMs are fantastic at small scale stuff. Like Ryan said, they will be wonderful at finding better alternatives for how to implement a certain function, but they are absolutely atrocious at large scale stuff. Like they will gleefully mess up your architecture and not even notice because they cannot fit it into their tiny electronic brains. So I think your scope will change, your outlook will change, but the activity itself of, you know, having a code review will remain. But I think the more interesting question is, if we iterate this more quickly, you know, do you really want to do another code review every other hour because your, you know, AI using colleague is just churning out increments at such a horrendous rate? You know, like Ryan says, I don't think anyone has the answer yet. We're just sort of bumping into problems. Like 1 or 2 weeks ago, I was listening to somebody complain that now they got so many bug reports that were obviously AI generated, and he was really happy about the bug reports, but the sheer number and the quantity. Size of them was just, it was a real problem for him. And and then the suggestion was, well, use the AI to review the bug reports, and
yay.
Yeah.
So I will point out something, you know, while we've talked about, like, it will produce code that you never thought to write. It will also produce code that you would never write. So like, for example, if you've got an application and most of your application, there's an actual, like an adapter class that you've been using for interacting with this specific external component. And the situation I'm thinking of is like, I had an adapter for Docker. So everything that I had done, it always goes through the adapter for Docker. And so then you write tests and whatever else, and you're like, okay, I'd like to add this additional Docker feature. But I was not clear enough or concise enough, or maybe I was. It's like, so I asked it to do this extra functionality, and guess what? It created its own interactions with Docker that didn't use the existing one. Right. The test passed, everything looked fine. Great, go shoot. But then I realized later, I'm like, oh, you just redid everything that was common functionality in this other adapter. Ugh.
Yes.
Now I have to go to tell you to go and like redo it with that now. Like, but right. Then you're trying to decide, do I bring up a new context and try to throw this, or do I just commit this and move? And like, how do you actually solve this problem? Do I throw it all away and start over? Like, it works though, but I mean, it works. Like, so like, you still need, like, it's, I would say, and I've had a checkered past with code reviews over the course of my career, I would say that it's even more important that you review the tests, and it's more important that you review the code now, because you can't trust them, because you think like, okay, I've worked with Jim for, you know, 15 years or 5 years or whatever, and everything that Jim does is good. I'm just going to give it a cursory glance over. Claude is not Jim. Right. Just because Claude did something really good once does not imply that Claude's going to do something really good the next time.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask, so the code review thing, I think we've covered that. So I was going to say, you know, going back to thinking about agile development teams, I have a hypothesis and wanted to get your feedback on it, which is that I preach this all the time in medical devices, like to be very, very clear about prototyping versus production quality code, and that prototyping fast and getting kind of product level feedback, like doing a prototype and getting product level feedback, is fantastically valuable and should be done early and cannot be confused with writing production quality code. But I feel like with LLMs as a tool, that prototyping becomes easier. And so you can explore user feedback. You can get it. Just, hey, does this make sense? Does that, like, I have a product idea that might work like this, and here's something you can actually play with. Does this make sense? I feel like getting to that, exploring that space and prototyping is going to be quicker and easier. And so that's going to affect how teams work.
Yeah.
But then the danger again becomes even more, it becomes even greater that could be confused with production quality code. But that prototyping is now a superpower. Do you agree? What do you think about that?
I completely agree. So, I mean, this is always the danger of prototypes, right? That some executive who doesn't know anything about anything would say, wait, it works already. Fantastic. Let's ship. It's like, no.
Hey. AI doesn't solve this problem. And oh no, yeah. It just made it worse.
So I think you touched on two very interesting and sort of related things here, Jeff. One of which is, I think that AI serves to shift even more stuff to the left. And you know, this is a common expression in Agile, right? Shift left, shift thinking about quality, about tests, for example, further to the left or further towards the requirements phase, perhaps. And, you know, LLMs in that sense shift a lot of things to the left. For instance, because maybe now a product owner who has some technical skills can dare to write, to have a prototype generated, which they wouldn't have had the skills nor the time for before. But now they can sort of hack something together. And yes, it's, you know, it's just a prototype, but they've got something to show to the customers or to the devs, and like, you know, I figured it should work something like this, and it will be supremely useful. And so shift left is the one thing, and shortening iteration cycles is the other, which is, you know, the other superpower of LLMs, and which is the same thing, right? You know, you can just figure something out or make a prototype very, very quickly, very, very briefly, and then learn from it and move on. But once more, I think it makes it ever more crucial to keep a very firm grip on the reins.
And the last thing that I've said this before in when we've talked about it, I'm really excited about LLMs just as, you know, as someone who I constantly have this imposter syndrome, but just this feeling of drowning because there are so many new technologies that I just don't have the time to learn. I can use LLMs to jumpstart me or bootstrap me from zero to one. And once there's something on the screen that kind of works, I can usually then apply my general programming skill, my general engineering taste to improve it and make it where I understand it, re-architect and whatever. But like, you know, to generate a working Bluetooth application, I feel like would take me a week to just like go through the courses to learn something. Or I can have an LLM generate. I'm like, oh, that's how it works. That's not so hard. I can understand that. And getting from that zero to one is now not days or weeks of learning a new technology. It's 20 minutes of playing with it. And you have something there that shows you the basics of that new technology. And it could be, you know, it could be Docker. It could be Bash scripts. It could be desktop applications. It could be, you know, JavaScript for my website, whatever, like all of these things that would normally be very intimidating to learn enough to even get started. At least that barrier is so much lower now. And that really is exciting for me.
Yeah.
Yep. So, and speaking of how to get started and kind of to wrap this up, because we got lives, we're real people. We got lives and dogs and cats and families. Like we're legitimate human beings doing a podcast. We can't just stay here all day. So to wrap it up, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to try it out. You know, the barrier for entry might seem really high and it might feel, oh, I'm noob. We're all noobs. We're all noobs to this. This is the brave noob world of AI exploration. So don't be afraid to get it. Just try it out. Start it out. There, you know, we'll talk as we go further in this podcast about some of the other different models and some of the other things that you can try and kind of give you an idea of like some of the space that's out there and how it works. So don't be afraid to do that. Be curious about it, but also be cautious about it. Don't ever take your hands off the reins. Pay attention to what it's doing. You got to trust your engineering intuition, you know. Even young guys that are young folks that are getting out there and just starting, like trust your engineering intuition. I think that the seasoned veterans that are worried about like, you know, well, I've built up all this. You still need that intuition. That intuition that you've built up is super important to have still. So
it's even more important because everything is so much faster.
Even more important. Yep.
And junior engineers are going to have to be careful to learn that intuition, to develop that experience. That I know that's a common refrain I hear is that people are worried that now junior engineers who don't actually have to write the code themselves aren't going to learn like the hard won lessons that senior engineers have learned bashing their head against things.
So. They will learn them. They will just learn them differently than we learned them. Like that's I want to be clear. Like this is there is always hope. You know, we can do this.
And I don't say that as a cynic of
I hear you. Yeah.
I guess it's just a bit of a warning to the junior engineers out there. Like you must understand the code that you are responsible for. And sometimes that understanding has to come from typing in the semicolons yourself. So do at least do some of that.
Yeah. And also, you know, as the saying goes, good judgment comes from experience. Experience comes from bad judgment. You know, you will find spectacular ways of messing up. That is how you become a decent engineer, I think.
Yeah, experience is what you get right after you need it.
Yep.
Yes, indeed.
So that's how you learn everything. That is everything. Yeah. You just be bad at stuff for as long as you need to be until you figure out that you're not as bad as you used to be.
And LLMs do not change that. So, like, junior engineers will still be necessary, will still be around, and they will still evolve into senior engineers eventually after they've fallen on their faces enough times. We all have very flat noses, in case you can't see us, the listeners.
All right, we should wrap this up. This has been the Agile Embedded Podcast. I'm Jeff Gable.
And I'm Luca Gianni.
And we will see you next time. Thanks.
All right, let's wrap this up.
Hello, dear listeners. Luca here. As I was cutting this episode, it occurred to me that we had never actually spelled out where to find the respective podcasts. So let me just add that here. So the Agile Embedded Podcast can be found at agileembeddedpodcast.com. And the Embedded AI Podcast, quite unsurprisingly, is at embeddedaipodcast.com if you want to check them out. That's all. Thank you.